Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with SocianWorks, a global forum helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Ecosystemic Futures investigates this expansive and hyper-connected paradigm and explores frameworks to help us achieve more beneficial futures. I am Marco Annunziata, your host today. I'm the co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economics PhD and the former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. Prior to GE, I worked in policy and in finance, and my expertise lies at the intersection of global economic and financial trends with technology and innovation. My guest today is Dr. Renard Hsu. Renard is a sustainability and climate change specialist. He serves as the first president of the Malaysia Carbon Market Association. He is a board of advisor member for SentGPS and group head of sustainability for Yinsun, where he is responsible for advancing his organization's work in the field of climate change and sustainability. Renard has held leadership roles on climate issues in both international organizations like the World Economic Forum and in public listed companies. He's a supervisor at the Cambridge Institute of Sustainability Leadership, a presidential fellow of Malaysia's National Youth Council. He has served on the Working Group of Sustainability Accounting Standards Board and is the recipient of a long list of prizes that I will not read out because they would take most of our podcast time. Renard is a graduate of Cambridge University and the UNSW, and I am delighted to welcome him to the podcast. Renard, welcome. And is there anything more you want to tell the audience about your background and your current responsibilities?
Thank you very much, Marco, for the very kind introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here on this podcast and really looking forward to our conversation today.
Outstanding. Renard, you've been working for quite some time on carbon markets, on the energy transition, climate sustainability issues, and your experience is focused in emerging Asia, where you are located. A lot of your work has been there, and it's a crucial perspective because much as a lot of the discussions, sustainability and the energy transition focuses on Europe and the US, the fact is Asia, emerging Asia, is where the strongest economic growth is taking place. So achieving the right balance in Asia is crucial. So let me start with this. You currently have responsibility for carbon markets development. So from your experience in Malaysia and in the region, what is the economic case for carbon markets versus other policy tools?
Yeah, I'll probably start off by saying that if some of you might have been following some of the COP29 developments that took place last year at Baku, Azerbaijan. And quite clearly, one of the asks from a lot of developing countries was actually a commitment to climate finance of about 1.3 trillion. But of course, the actual commitment that, you know, was committed fell short of that figure. So in some ways, I think there's been a lot of discussions and conversations about how carbon markets could potentially play a role in sort of bridging the gap in terms of financing. Well, at least this is the perspective that has resonated, you know, quite strongly from countries in the global south. Now, I think carbon markets in itself, from an economic fundamental perspective, right, promises cost efficiency. But the reality, I suppose, in Southeast Asia, in ASEAN in general, is a little bit more nuanced. Like many markets, carbon markets specifically here in Asia, it's still quite immature. They are driven primarily by...
Renard, yeah. I'll interrupt you just a second because I realized, and it's my fault, but maybe we should take one step back. And for those in our audience who might not be familiar with carbon markets, what is a carbon market and how does it actually work?
Absolutely. I suppose in terms of definition, there are really two broad categorizations of carbon markets. The first category is what we call a voluntary carbon market. And the second category is what we call a compliance market. So an example of a voluntary carbon market is when carbon credits, typically one credit represents one ton of carbon or CO2 equivalent that is either removed or sequestered, is being auctioned, right, on some sort of platform. And the private sector could potentially go into some of this trading platform to purchase credits, and then they can retire some of this credits in order to claim neutrality. So as its name suggests, in this first category, it's a voluntary carbon market. So companies, private sector can do this completely on a voluntary basis. There is no regimented tool that sort of governs and says that they must, you know, be involved in this space. It's completely up to the intention of the entities that's participating in this market. Now, and shapes and forms as to how this can actually take place. The first is that a lot of us have probably heard of as a carbon tax. So the way a carbon tax works is that typically governments would define a certain threshold in terms of, you know, the limit, sort of the threshold amount of emissions before a certain corporation or entity can actually get taxed. So just to give you an example, in the case of Singapore, I think 25,000 tons of carbon that is being emitted is sort of the baseline that has been set. So any companies that actually hit this threshold and beyond, right, will actually have to pay a certain carbon tax levy as a result of actually exceeding that threshold. So this is how a carbon tax actually works. Now, another form of compliance mechanism in the carbon markets is what we call the emissions trading scheme. So the way an emissions trading scheme, or ETS in short, basically works is, once again, there is a certain quota for different industry sectors. And if an industry sector were to exceed the allowances of this threshold, what they would need to do is that they have to go to the market to purchase, you know, like say credits, right, or allowances in short, in order to neutralize their, you know, the amount of surplus emissions that they have actually incurred. If the quota has been set, and if an entity were to emit much lower than the threshold that has been set in an emissions trading scheme scenario, then any surplus that comes from that, they can actually sell those allowances back into the market, and another entity can actually purchase it. So this is another form, right, of a compliance mechanism that can actually take place. So in a nutshell, you have both the voluntary and the compliance market. At the moment, the compliance market is worth, you know, like way much more. Like you're talking about 200 to 300 billion that's being traded, right, just on carbon credits alone. Whereas in a voluntary carbon market space, we're looking at about 2 billion plus. There's a lot of opportunities still for growth, alluding back to some of the points that I've made earlier about closing the climate financing gap. I do strongly feel that the carbon markets have a strong role to play in sort of bridging a lot of this climate financing
gap. And this is because, if I understand it correctly, Renard, these things, the carbon market and the carbon tax, there are two things going on. One, okay, the underlying principle, of course, is we want to reduce emissions. Then what we do with these markets is, one, create incentives for lower emissions. And so, for example, with a carbon tax, what we're saying is, well, there are externalities involved in some activities, like industrial activities that create emissions. Those externalities, so the negative effect of emissions on the climate, are not captured in the cost of production normally. And so what the government does in this case is saying, okay, I will impose a tax which represents that externality and therefore creates a disincentive for the company to create emissions, or an incentive to either find more cleaner ways of production. So there's an incentive to reduce emissions. And then at the same time, there is a creation of revenue, right? Because with the tax, we raise revenue. And so this is the sense in which also these markets can mobilize revenue, which can then go towards this financing gap you were mentioning, and therefore mobilize the financing for climate research, climate science development, etc. Is that a good way of looking at it?
Oh, yeah, yes. I mean, absolutely spot on. Yeah.
Perfect. So tell me again, this tells us why the carbon market, as you said, is an important tool for raising the necessary financing. And you have expressed confidence that actually this market can continue to grow and therefore play a bigger role. I'm curious, in terms of, this comes from my experience as an economist, in terms of market efficiency, how does a carbon market help us to to achieve the right level of price discovery. I guess what I'm saying, to be a little bit clearer, is as we try to pursue a big goal like climate sustainability, there are various ways of getting at it, and there is ongoing research in science and technology. What we want to do is do it in the most efficient way possible. And then there is always some tension between having the government deciding where the efforts should go versus the private sector with various efforts and research trying to find the best solutions. And normally prices are in any market, prices are what help us achieve an efficient distribution of resources. What is the role of price discovery and market efficiency here when we talk about carbon markets?
Yeah, so we all know, I think, that carbon markets in some ways, right, promises sort of cost efficiency. But, you know, as I've mentioned earlier, I think the reality in Southeast Asia, or at least where I'm from, right, the situation is a bit more nuanced, partly because when you talk about carbon markets in this region, it's still at its very nascent stage, so immature to a certain extent, right? A lot of the pricing mechanism is really very much driven by external compliance rather than domestic demand at this point in time. Genuine price discovery, right, it's really constrained, just from my observation, right, by number one, the lack of liquidity. So our ASEAN, the Southeast Asian carbon markets at the moment is quite constrained. You have credits that are being auctioned in the Malaysian market, and it's only sold to, you know, like Malaysian buyers. Likewise, in Indonesia, Thailand, and Singapore. So liquidity, right, is still a problem that we have to, you know, solve to a certain extent. I guess some of the other challenges that have sort of come out that sort of impeding, right, actual price discovery is really around issues around transparency and then questions around the credibility of baselines of some carbon projects that have actually come out. And then we can talk a little bit more about this. I think some of you have probably heard in the news that they are bogus projects. So overstatement of, you know, claims on carbon credits for certain projects, which may not necessarily be true. So in Southeast Asian markets, we have also definitely encountered, right, situations like that, which is an impediment, right, for true actual discovery. Because, but just to give you an example, there was a Guardian article that was issued, right, a couple of years ago, questioning, right, the credibility of some of the carbon credits that have came out from nature-based projects. And as a result, you know, of that article, like, prices started dropping, you know, quite drastically, right, through, you know, on some of these nature-based projects. So you can see that there are definitely external factors that are also at play here. Now, compared, of course, to more direct policy tools, right, such as carbon taxes, I think it's a bit more clear-cut because the government of the day basically dictates, right, how much they think a carbon tax, right, should be worth. And it's basically, you know, like a top-down approach, a flat structure. Anyone who exceeds a certain threshold, as I've mentioned earlier, will be slapped essentially, right, with this pricing like mechanism. It's very clear-cut. So in that sense, I think compared to direct policy tools such as carbon taxes, right, in some ways, carbon taxes do provide more predictability, I guess, in terms of revenues. And to a certain extent, I would say maybe simpler in terms of its administration as well. Whereas if you're talking about on the voluntary carbon market side, things can fall short, right, without strong oversight or regulatory compliance as such.
It's a very important point you have raised. I mean, to clarify it further for our audience, what you're saying is, in a sense, a carbon tax is a very simple and transparent mechanism. You, beyond a certain threshold, you emit more, you pay more. The government taxes you, and then we can invest the money in climate technologies. In the case of carbon markets, we are, in a sense, creating a new currency, right? There are projects that are aimed to improve sustainability and reduce emissions, and those are worth credits. And the credibility issue you were pointing to before are, well, in some cases, have we really verified that these projects that we are saying are worth this much? Do they actually reduce emissions, take carbon out of the atmosphere to the level that we think they do? So this is a very, very, very important issue in the design of the mechanism, but also in terms of the impact it has on the economy of the region. So actually, let me switch for a second here to the economic dimensions, which are very, very important, because we're talking about taxes, we're talking about changes in incentives to industrial and economic activity. Now, one of the concerns that has emerged in the case of the US and Europe is, by doing this, you run the risk of increasing energy costs for the industrial system and therefore reducing competitiveness. Is there a concern that carbon pricing mechanisms in Southeast Asia might have a negative impact on the competitive position of Southeast Asia economies compared to, say, China or other manufacturing hubs?
I think absolutely. I think there are obviously been a lot of conversations here in Southeast Asia, especially around the carbon border adjustment mechanism that the EU intends to implement. And then, of course, the contention around that is, how do you deal with this, right? Do we need to have our own, you know, like carbon taxes in order to retain, you know, financial outflow, say, to the EU from a protectionism perspective? Or questions around, you know, supply chain of materials, like, is it going to lead to an increase, right, in cost as a result of some of these external mechanisms that are already happening that would have a direct impact clearly on the competitiveness, right, of Southeast Asian businesses? I think it's a very real conversations that entities are having. And because of that as well, I think for Malaysia specifically, in budget 2025, our Prime Minister announced that we will actually have our own carbon tax mechanism kicking in, you know, starting with the iron, steel and energy sectors. But of course, there is a much larger plan to, of course, bring in the other industries as well. But once again, these are the three sectors that are most impacted by CBAM, right? The mechanism that the EU has introduced. So yes, I mean, definitely, I think these are definitely areas that has a huge impact on competitiveness. But maybe one point to make as well is that there has always been this critical question, you know, in actually developing projects, right, for carbon credit, it's actually not easy. Some of the challenges that we've been hearing from project developers is that there is actually quite a significant cost that is involved when they actually want to opt for independent standard status, you know, the likes of RERA and Gold Standard. That's actually an outflow of a huge amount of capital for project design and documentation, and even to get a proper verification and validation of this project. So to our point and our discussion that, you know, we have mentioned earlier, on top of this cost that project developers need to incur, there's also this trust issue, right? Can people actually trust the credibility or integrity of the carbon credits that are coming from this project? And as a result of that, there's actually been an emergence of what we call META standards, right? So the International Council for Voluntary Carbon Markets, Voluntary Carbon Market Initiative, you know, independent raters of carbon projects like B0, for example, all of this are actually slapping on, right, additional layers and layers and layers of safeguards that need to be in place. So at the end of the day, what's really happening is that it's costing, right, project developers a lot more to actually to be able to produce, right, this so-called high integrity carbon credits. And this is a real genuine concern and challenge, right, that we are hearing from the ground, especially in Southeast Asia, and probably also one of the reasons why you're probably not seeing as much projects coming out from this region. I think it's because of all this conversations around competitiveness, you know, like trust issues, meter standards that have evolved, and, you know, like, is it truly leading us to a path rate of greater efficiency, or is it really creating more administrative burden, right? And where do we really draw the line in terms of trying to find that sweet spot or balance?
It's very interesting. So if you have a project, if you start a project that would generate carbon credits because maybe you're planting a forest or doing something that contributes positively to emission reductions, who validates the extent of the project? Who validates the number of credits you should receive? Is there an accredited international organization? Is it a situation where you have different independent agencies like credit rating agencies? How does it actually work?
Yeah, so that's a great point, Marco. Actually, they are independent standards, like RERA. So RERA, for example, currently dominates, right, the carbon markets. 70% of the methodologies that are being used out there, right, are based on RERA's recommendation, right, based on RERA's methodology. So a lot of projects actually go through, right, that whole certification, verification process, right, trying to align, right, to, you know, the specific methodologies. And there are many ways of being able to generate carbon credits, right? It could come from tech-based. Say, for example, if you involve in carbon capture utilization and storage tech technologies, which represent, you know, carbon removals from direct air capture, a lot of this has opportunities to generate carbon credits. And then, of course, on the flip side, you also have nature-based projects, right? From getting involved in activities such as afforestation or reforestation, if you're able to demonstrate that you meet, right, some of the proof and validate your methods, right, that you're able to cut down, remove, sequester X amount of carbon, then a lot of that can essentially be translated into carbon credits that you can trade off, right, through different platforms. So there are different standard setters out there. Like RERA is one of the biggest ones. There's also Gold Standard. That's the Climate Action Reserve as well in the US. So there's a lot of this different methodologies. Having said so, international standards is one thing. I have to say that domestically or perhaps regionally in countries such as Indonesia and Thailand, they too have actually developed their own set of domestic standards. Mm-hmm. So just to give you an idea, in Thailand in itself, they're already close to about 70 plus methodologies that they've developed. In Indonesia, about 50 plus. In Malaysia, we're still very nascent. There has been talks about wanting to develop a forest carbon offset or FBO protocol, but a lot of that is still in conversation currently. One of the ideas, Marco, that we have been toiling around, right, across the carbon market associations is whether, you know, in order to cut down, right, on some of the, you know, exorbitant costs, right, you know, that the independent standard setters are charging, is there a possibility that we could promote mutual recognition, right, of domestic standards within our own regional block? So these are some of the key priorities and that, you know, we are trying to push for. In fact, one particular initiative, if I could, you know, mention it, is actually the ASEAN Common Carbon Framework, or ACC, at the Malaysian Carbon Market Association, together with our counterparts, right, in Singapore, Indonesia, and Thailand, have actually gotten together, and we are really trying to push, right, for this mutual recognition of methodologies, because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of challenges, a lot of bottlenecks around the exorbitant cost, around the availability of verifiers and value. And we are of the opinion that if we are able to push this agenda forward, then we will be able to actually also at the same time build up a pipeline, right, of verifiers and validators that would be very familiar with the methodologies that we are trying to promote. Hopefully, I think this would be able to spur more growth from a supply perspective. You know, once again, going back to my earlier argument about wanting to resolve some of the challenges that I've highlighted.
It's another very important point, because you mentioned earlier the potential for this carbon market to grow in size. Mm. And if I understand you correctly now, the challenge here is the following. And tell me if I understand this correctly, but without this mutual recognition of standards, if I develop a carbon project, a carbon reducing project in Malaysia, maybe it's carbon capture, maybe it's nature based, I create carbon credits, but these carbon credits are then validated by a Malaysian supervising authority or entity, but then somebody sitting in Indonesia without mutual recognition cannot buy these credits, because then the Indonesian system would say, well, these are not validated. And therefore, you end up with a market which is fragmented. And if it's fragmented, then it cannot be liquid. And so it limits the potential growth of the market. So that's why this mutual recognition is so important.
And you're absolutely spot on, Marco. So through the ASEAN Common Carbon Framework, that's exactly what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to ensure that at least within the ASEAN region, there is mutual recognition of this standard and methodology, so that the carbon credits that come from this project, right, can achieve sort of mutual recognition. And the whole purpose of this, of course, is to ensure that there is greater liquidity, right, across the ASEAN region. Well, at least that is sort of the aspiration or the goal that we're trying to get to. It's, yes.
Yeah, because the greater liquidity in turn would make it easier for more carbon capture or carbon reducing projects to get underway, because there would be greater certainty that the financing capital is there, that the market is there.
Absolutely. And that's exactly it. You're spot on, right, about the challenges that we face, right? I mean, the Global South have been saying that, you know, like there's just isn't enough capital inflow, right, to support climate mitigation adaptation initiatives. So there is really no time to wait. If we really see climate change, right, as the defining issue of our generation, if we're really serious about wanting to drive the energy transition forward, I think these are the areas that we have to start prioritizing. This is by no means, of course, a perfect system, but we should never let perfection, right, get into the way of progress. And we really have to start. So which is why, you know, like a few carbon market associations in ASEAN, the five groups of us, right, we have decided that we're not going to wait anymore. If this is an agenda that we're really serious about pushing, right, let's do it. And hence, you know, one key outcome was like really at COP29 last year, we signed and exchange a memorandum of collaboration. And the hard work, right, really starts now, like trying to get the ecosystem players together, trying to ensure that there's proper coordination, trying to iron out where are the challenges, right, that different countries are facing. How do we, you know, as a collective, define high integrity carbon credits? How can this credit actually be used, right? So there needs to be some sort of a clean guidance, right, and often level on how some of this credit can be used. And also going back to some of our earlier conversations around carbon pricing discovery, right, there is a difference between tag and nature-based and how they're being priced, depending on the complexities and the efforts that are involved. A lot of this would have to converge, right, at some point in time. So the landscape is complex, challenging, but yet at the same time, very exciting, I have to say.
It's extremely exciting. And in fact, I want to push a little bit more on these international issues, because and going international in the sense of going beyond the Southeast Asia region, because you mentioned earlier some of the more recent legislative initiatives of the European Union, which essentially do the following, as far as I understand it. They essentially say, look, within Europe, within our region, we have certain carbon pricing mechanisms. So producers have to pay a certain amount, depending on what they do, to ensure that the externality of their industrial activity is taken into account. Then we import products from other regions which might not have the same environmental laws, and therefore producers somewhere else might be able to sell at cheaper prices because they don't have the same constraints, or essentially they don't have the same mechanism to shoulder the responsibility for the externality. So at that point, the European Union said, if I think that is the case, if I think that you want to export to me a product which has been produced without capturing the externality of emissions, then I'm going to impose a tax on you to create a tariff on you, to create a level playing field with my own producers. And this, of course, to me, raises two risks. One is that it becomes another potential avenue for just straightforward protectionism. The second is that can become incredibly subjective, because if we don't agree, if you and I are two different countries and we don't agree on how to price carbon, how to price different projects, then my attitude in imposing tariffs on your products is completely arbitrary. So from your perspective, you've been involved in all these discussions. How much progress is being made at the international, the global international level to create something that is a bit more harmonious?
You know, that is really, truly the trillion-dollar question, isn't it? I mean, the World Trade Organization, WTO, right? I believe the executive director at one point in time, correct me if I'm wrong, and you know, and if I'm not mistaken, I think there was this conversation or dialogue really around, can we, right, actually achieve a unified, right, global carbon price? I think that truly is a trillion-dollar question. And I suppose the argument that has been laid out for us quite clearly is that until we are able to actually achieve that, that's always going to be carbon leakage, right? So, you know, say, if the EU were to have imposed, right, a certain carbon tax or CBAM mechanism that prices carbon a lot higher, the market would self-correct itself. Like, entities or businesses would then transfer their businesses to elsewhere that either has no carbon tax or has, you know, a much lower carbon price. Like, essentially, I think that's just how markets work, right? And then it goes back to the whole question around, you know, like, what the mechanism that was introduced to begin with, right, actually achieving its intended objective, perhaps for a certain region, but it still doesn't, you know, get to the root of the problem where you're trying to really mitigate emissions. It's just transferring it from, you know, one like place, point A to point B, essentially. And I think this is something that we don't even have to look at a global basis. Even in Asia, some of the questions that have come out, right, is essentially, how do we address this carbon leakage issue, right? I mean, if Singapore, our neighboring country, right, continues to price carbon highly, but in Malaysia, Thailand, or Indonesia, we don't do that, it's quite natural for businesses to essentially just, you know, like, transfer or opt to set up their entities elsewhere, mm-hmm. to essentially avoid having to pay, right, higher taxes. Yeah. And this is a real problem. I don't know if you know, within this podcast, right, it would sort of it would be able to come to a solution, right, or even be able to address this problem. But I've been following quite closely, and these are some of the conversations that have quite clearly emerged. It remains to be a huge challenge. And I don't think, you know, like, Southeast Asia, we have necessarily found a solution to this yet.
It's a very, very fair point. Very fair point, Renard. And your observation that the risk of pollution emissions simply being shifted from one country to another is real. We can see some of it in the numbers. If we look at the global greenhouse gas emissions, they've kept increasing. So with all the efforts we've made, the global greenhouse gas emissions have just kept increasing on and on. So there is a little bit of that happening. At the same time, the efforts that are being made both regionally and globally for these carbon markets are crucial, because, again, as you said, there are cases where the private markets can just do the job by themselves, because when the price is simply based on demand and supply, price eventually depends on what consumers are willing to pay. And innovators will try to innovate and create technologies that yield greater efficiency, more productivity, better products, and the pricing mechanism will do its job. Here, the problem is much more difficult, because there is no demand side that can determine the efficient prices. So what we're really trying to figure out is, we are developing different technologies to help the climate transition. We need to find a way that tells us which technologies are better than others, either in creating energy efficiency or in capturing carbon. So it seems to me that there are perhaps two avenues to explore, or two avenues that are being explored here. One is the price-based one, which is energy efficiency. So are there technical solutions from innovative companies in Southeast Asia or elsewhere that can develop solar panels that have greater efficiency or better batteries? This by itself can provide energy at lower costs. So here, then, the pricing system will work. It will incentivize. People will want more of these technologies because they translate in cheaper energy. On the other side, you have technologies that focus on carbon capture or other forms of carbon reduction. And there is currently no easy price discovery mechanism. So it becomes almost more of a technology and scientific problem. And you need scientists to assess and say, yes, we are confident that this technology is effective to this extent. And that's where the credibility problem also comes in. How do you see the progress being made, say, within Southeast Asia? Do you see more progress being made in the coming years from a technology perspective of us being able to better assess the value and the efficacy of different projects? Do you see it as coming more from the energy price side?
Yeah. I think that's quite an interesting question, right, Marco? So I guess at the heart of your question, essentially, it's really this debate, right, about what is the return on investment, right, ROI, between technology versus markets. And I would probably say that just my observation in the Southeast Asian scenario is that the ROI and market mechanisms typically often depends on the ability to channel funds towards transformative technologies, just as the ones that you've mentioned, right? The one that would be able to generate and give you, you know, like higher energy efficiency. But while that is primarily true, like for a certain group or demographic, specifically multinational corporations that I've seen of, but I'm also seeing a trend that is it tends to skew towards enabling offsetting as well, as opposed to actually reducing emissions at source. Specifically, this is referring to the carbon market space, right? And I guess the risk there probably is that it would create this delay, right, in sort of really focusing on necessary investments in technology such as direct air capture, maybe green hydrogen or any sort of next-gen renewables, you know, technology that you've mentioned earlier. I am seeing industrial emissions and energy demands also rising, given the fact that, you know, a lot of the countries here are in a developmental phase, right? Mm-hmm. So you are seeing a growth in trajectory, the boom of data centers, for example, right? Yes. Huge in Southeast Asia. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was this announcement about the special economic zone between Johor, Singapore. And I think a lot of multinational companies are really zooming in, right, to set up their data centers specifically in Asia. So we are seeing that energy demand is essentially going to go, you know, like increase, right? I suppose at an exponential rate. The critical question, I think, at the end of the day is still, you know, whether carbon markets, right, can actually help divert perhaps some of the capital from direct mitigation efforts, right, to it in favor of, I guess, like lower cost, right, short term offsets. Once again, I think that's observations, high level observations that you know we have in Southeast Asia, but I don't think it's necessarily conclusive, where we can sort of put our mark and sort of, you know, say that technology is really in favor of, you know, like market-based solutions at this point in time, at least from my observation.
It's a very good perspective. And I think one thing that has that plays to the region's advantage in Southeast Asia is that from an economic perspective, the region is so dynamic. You were saying it now. It's growing. Economic growth is going very fast and has been. It's been the fastest growing region in the global economy for decades, and it continues to be. So that creates both a faster growing energy demand, but it also creates a lot more dynamism and therefore a lot more incentive to come up with new solutions. And here I'm curious, are you seeing in the development of new technologies and new carbon solutions, how much are you seeing in terms of self-driven activity and discovery from the private sector side as opposed to government investment and government directed or incentivized projects?
Yeah, once again, that is such an interesting question, right? I suppose maybe once again, looking at the carbon market lens, I think carbon pricing mechanisms, right, specifically in our region, right, I think could sort of highlight more regional disparities, right, as opposed to more harmonization and unification. And I think Southeast Asian economies are really heavily reliant on energy intensive industries, right? Like specifically, I think manufacturing palm oil in Malaysia and Indonesia, which is quite common, petrochemicals, oil and gas. So a lot of this are typically industries that face heightened exposure when it comes to, you know, things like carbon costs. So to be very frank, I think without policies such as, you know, carbon border adjustment mechanisms or carbon tax, I think carbon pricing really risks driving, you know, like industries towards less regulated regions, as we've mentioned earlier, right? Reducing global emissions, so to speak. You know, like going back to your point earlier, are companies truly looking at opportunities, right, to be really innovative, or are they actually shifting, you know, like their entities, right? Hence, leading towards more towards carbon leakage. I have to say that I'm sort of noticing that the carbon leakage trend happening a little bit more in this space, really. Of course, not something that, you know, I necessarily moot for or in favor of, but I am sort of seeing that happening. And of course, I guess maybe while we see countries like China and EU, right, sort of really leveraging on their skill for technological advancements, right, like to mitigate impact, I think ASEAN economies are really caught, you know, like between the pressure of, number one, wanting to remain competitive still, versus, you know, whether they actually have the financial incentivization to actually adopt some of this technological resources, the innovation that you mentioned earlier, right, to decarbonize effectively. I think that, you know, we're really caught in that hot, how should I say that, like that corner of trying to decide, right? How do we stay competitive, or do we pursue, right, more, you know, like innovation to decarbonize rapidly? So it's a hard dilemma, I would say, for a lot of ASEAN countries.
There's a lot of interesting trade-offs and balancing acts in this discussion. And in fact, you know, you and I spoke earlier of the issue of global standards for carbon markets and how, to some extent, they would be desirable because they would make the market more liquid. They would create a more level playing field. On the other hand, it just strikes me that perhaps some level of fragmentation for a while is not too bad, because it allows for a degree of experimentation. And especially in this early stage of these markets, if we leave different countries and different regions scope for experimenting and finding better solutions before we force everybody onto a certain standard, maybe it's not too bad. Maybe it's a good balance to strike at this stage. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is a constant conversation that we are trying to have, right? So one of the things that I brought up earlier was that the ASEAN Carbon Market Associations, right, are trying to move for the ASEAN Common Carbon Framework to sort of promote regional methodologies, right, where ASEAN countries can actually mutually recognize one another. But of course, one of the challenges that we tend to face, right, is will this actually gain legitimacy, right, with the international community? Will they see this sort of standards that exist, right, at a domestic or regional level to be of lower quality, as opposed to, you know, the safeguards that the international community is trying to achieve? And I suppose in response to that, right, some of the analogies that have emerged is that, you know, we always say that, yeah, if we have to travel 5 kilometers, right, from our home to stay at our workplace, not everyone can afford to drive, right, in a Porsche or a Lamborghini. Sometimes you just have to make do with, you know, like a local car or a
hard yes. Lamborghini.
Yeah, yes. Lamborghini, right? Guinea. Or you could cycle or walk, right? That 5 kilometers. Mm-hmm. But you still achieve the end game, right? Which is to breach that 5 kilometer gap from your home to your workplace at the end of the day. So we have the opinion that they can coexist. You can have domestic methodologies and standards, and you can have international standards to coexist. They serve different markets. What would be interesting to see is actually the convergence and the acceptance, right, when we start moving towards more of the compliance-based markets with emissions trading scheme coming in, right? It'll be really interesting to see the dynamism of acceptance of this credit. The emissions unit will not change. What will change is, you know, how people perceive, right, certain concepts such as additionality, right? So in order to generate credits, like on top of just having verified emissions, you have all of these standards that you need to fulfill, you know. Are you meeting certain social safeguards? Are you contributing to biodiversity? And I think these are very hard conversations to breach, because the context, I would say, it's different. And also the readiness and maturity of the market as well, right? It's quite different as such. So it's very interesting to see how this would pan out at the end of the day.
Bernardo, we talked about so many complicated issues. There's one thing I wanted to ask you. You've worked inside some major corporations and publicly listed companies, helping them exactly on these issues. So what is your perspective? How do companies look at this complex landscape, and how do they react? Because, you know, I have no doubt, on the one hand, for companies, there is a clear existential pressure to remain competitive. They're facing regulatory pressures on some side. On the other hand, much like you and me, they also look at the planet around us and they think, yeah, you know, we want to do, to the extent possible, the right thing and the smart thing. How are you seeing companies behave and react in the current context? And what lessons would you take away for possible changes in incentives or development of these carbon market and carbon policies?
Yeah, I would probably say that I'm sort of a wide spectrum of organizations in Southeast Asia. On one hand, you have very mature companies, right, that have very clear carbon neutral, net zero targets, very clear climate aspirations and commitments that they have already made. And these are the sorts of companies that are very clear in terms of the roadmap of wanting to achieve, right, that net zero goal. So they will tell you specifically that there's almost a climate or carbon mitigation hierarchy that they approach, right? They'll first look at the opportunities, the low-hanging fruits, right, to cut down on emissions. So through any carbon reduction pathway, once they've exhausted everything that they can do, they'll move on to their next level, which is to really look at opportunities to invest in carbon removal technologies, direct air capture to the US, or even nature-based solutions. And then once they have done everything that they possibly could, balancing, of course, cost considerations, the third level is, you know, they'll just go out into the market to purchase high quality offsets, right, in order to retire some of those credits to achieve carbon neutrality. So mature companies like that are very clear in terms of their climate mitigation hierarchy, all the way down to the other end of the spectrum, where you have companies that are a little bit clueless. Like they know that they have to do something because there is this compliance regime, right, where if you're a publicly listed company, you actually have to start disclosing on your carbon footprint, and you have to show and demonstrate that you're actually doing something about it. So there are some companies that have started measuring some baseline in terms of their scope 1 and scope 2 emissions. And then, you know, they go to the market and they purchase some of these credits and they claim that, you know, they have retired them. And some of the companies also tend to be spotlighted, right, by NGOs or civil society organizations that are, you know, as actually greenwashing, right? So, yes. Some of their initiatives. So to be honest, that's quite a broad spectrum, I would say, of companies along this path, right, towards energy transition, which also means that, you know, there is a great opportunity and a lot of work, you know, cut out for us, right? The energy transition pathway at the end of the day, I would say, really doesn't lie solely, right, in just one particular company in the energy sector, right? It cuts across multiple spectrums. We really need all stakeholders. We always say here, we need to have a whole of government, all of society approach, really working very closely together in order to help drive more impacts, right, and help companies accelerate through the energy transition journey. I would probably also, if I may, just add a little bit, partly because there's a lot of companies here that are still very much focused, right, or centered around the oil and gas or fossil fuel-based industry. So I think these are the cut that really have to do their energy transition, right? I mean, if you're already in renewables or if you're in the green tech or climate tech space, right, the journey of transitioning isn't as much work, or there's, you know, less of a hurdle as compared to the so-called hard-to-abate sectors. Mm-hmm. And one of the trends that I'm seeing is that there's this science-based target initiative that has come out, which tries to align themselves to, you know, the Paris Agreement. There's all the talk about 1.5 degrees Celsius. At the moment, there's no pathway for oil and gas companies to align themselves to that. And of course, the allegations that has been coming out is that, oh, you know, this companies are already in oil and gas. So really what they should do is they should not be part of the center of the conversation. Let's leave them out. So I tend to, you know, maybe want to debate and challenge that a little bit, because in my opinion, I think if anything, I think it is this group of companies that need to be brought into conversation, right? Because they are the ones that actually need to transition the most. Sorry. Also jobs, right, that we're talking about. But in Malaysia, we have national oil based companies, a lot of them are rooted and trained, right, in this sector for the longest time. You know, you're talking about like more than 50 plus years. The transition isn't going to happen overnight. You have to really look at the whole education system in terms of the job opportunities in the renewable sector. How are we incentivizing people, right, to have a little bit more security in wanting to pursue renewable based courses and subjects, right, at this university, to be trained, to be well equipped. The sort of conversations, right, it's truly a little bit more complex, right, than just I suppose what some civil society organizations have made it out to be.
It's a very good point, because, you know, from my perspective, you look at oil and gas companies and you can say simplistically, well, these are companies that produce, they are at the basis of greenhouse gas emissions, are these companies. And clearly they have profits and they have people employed, so they have a vested interest in maintaining their activity. Whereas in a hypothetical green future, those companies no longer exist. So you can do it two ways. You can either ignore them, in which case they have a vested interest in pushing against the transition, or you can have a more open conversation with them so that together we can identify a future for their shareholders, for their employees, and for everybody. Recognizing, by the way, that for the foreseeable future, we need these companies, because if we were to shut down oil and gas production today, it would be such a disaster, not just from an economic standpoint, but it would most likely backfire from a climate standpoint as well. So I think it's a very, very important and pragmatic attitude to say, look, the conversation should be open to everybody. I completely agree. Bernard, we've had a fantastic conversation. We've covered such a large number of topics. Is there anything that we should have covered and we didn't get to, or otherwise, or on top of that, any fundamental message that you would really like our audience to take away from this conversation?
No, I guess for myself, I would probably want to say that the energy transition is really an opportunity for us to make a positive change and impact. And really, there's an opportunity here for us to leverage on a whole of government, all of society approach. Maybe just to quote, right, you know, Michelle Yeoh's famous movie, we need everything, everywhere, all at once, right, in order to really ensure that the energy transition, right, and the net zero future that we all imagine, right, can actually take place. I suppose that would be some of my key messages.
That is excellent. Dr. Renard Siu, this was a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for being on our podcast today. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you once again for having me.
And thanks everyone for joining us today. Check out the season's new episodes as we continue to explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and new business models, and how the convergence is reshaping industry and what all this means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever else you listen to your podcasts, and you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.